Please look at this, at least for this evening, as a kind of Bible lesson. And if I'm not making myself clear as we go along, feel free to say, hey, say that again, or what do you mean by that, or something of that nature. If you have a question and it deals with something that I will be covering at a later time, I will tell you to wait till we get to that point, and then I will cover it. But I do encourage you to participate through questions, because we want to make it as clear and as meaningful as we can. We're thinking about prophecy, the end times. Perhaps, although not all prophecy is about the end times, so not everything we will say will have to do with the second coming as such, because some prophecy does not deal with the second coming. In fact, this is one of the sources of confusion, I think, when it comes to interpreting Bible prophecy. Many of the things that in the Bible were actually fulfilled in the Old Testament or were fulfilled with the first coming of Christ are thought by many to all bunch up at the end, at the second coming of Christ. So one of the things that we will be trying to do is to show that prophecy has been fulfilled, is being fulfilled, and will be fulfilled. And when you try to bunch it all up right at the end, then you get a little complicated and, I think, unbiblical. But it is a very interesting subject. And when we are talking about it, when we're talking about Bible prophecy, in the minds of many people, the most important part of it is the role of the Jewish people and the present nation of Israel. This is the view, for instance, of Hal Lindsey. I have his book here, The Late Great Planet Earth. Art was saying tonight, will I need my Bible? I said, no, as long as you've got Hal Lindsey, that'll be enough. I was only kidding. But I have Hal Lindsey's book here, and this is his view, namely that prophecy is focused mainly on the Jewish state today. As he says in this book on page 173, keep your eyes on the Middle East. Keep your eyes on the Middle East. And if you read further in what he says, this is how he describes Israel's part in the end times. On page 40 and following in this book, he says, to be specific about Israel's great significance as a sign of the time, there are three things that must happen. First, he says, the Jewish nation must be reborn in the land of Palestine. And in modern times, of course, that happened in 1948. Second, he says, the Jews must repossess old Jerusalem and the sacred sites. And this happened in 1967. This book, by the way, was written shortly after that. And he says, the third thing that has to happen is that the Jews will rebuild their ancient temple of worship on its historic site. Has that happened yet? Well, that's the thing that hasn't happened. And that's the thing that I'm sure Hal Lindsey prays for every day. Because that, in his mind and the minds of many people, is the next thing that has to happen in order to trigger the end of the world. And so he says, there remains but this one more event to completely set the stage for Israel's part in the last great act of her historical drama, and this is to rebuild the ancient temple of worship upon its old site. I don't know if you remember after the 1967 war, but there were rumors going around at that time that a trainload of Indiana Bedford stone was on its way to Israel. Anybody hear that? That was in the news. I saw that in a news report. I heard that from various sources, that they had already ordered a whole trainload of Indiana Bedford stone to rebuild the temple. Now somewhere, either that's a very slow boat or that train got sidetracked somewhere because it never got there. But this is the way that people were thinking at that time. Boy, the temple, that's next. That's just got to be next. because everything is set now for the temple. And if the temple is rebuilt, says Lindsay, there will be two things that follow. First, they will reinstitute the Jewish worship according to the law of Moses, with sacrifices and all that in the general time of Christ's return. And second, there will be a desecration of the temple in the time immediately preceding Christ's return. And Lindsay said, when he wrote this book, and this was published in 1970, he says, if this is the time that this writer believes it is, there will soon begin the construction of this temple. Well, it hasn't happened yet, and Lindsay has revised his own prophecies since he wrote it. But this is still the way that he would think. This is the way so many people that are interpreting Bible prophecy think. They believe that the Jews are the key to Bible prophecy today and to the end of the world in general. I'm sure you've studied this here at Monroeville. You have a lot of tracts in your tract rack back there that have to do something with this, have something to do with this way of thinking. Maybe some of you have a Scofield Reference Bible. You haven't repented yet. Maybe you still have the Scofield. And if you have read the footnotes in the Scofield Reference Bible, you'll find that it's the same thing as Hal Lindsey's saying. You see, he didn't make this up. He's just popularizing the footnotes in Scofield. There are many cults that take a similar position. Jehovah's Witnesses take a rather similar position, and certainly the Armstrong cults do today. Many of the popular studies of the book of Revelation take this position. The ones that you can buy in the paperbacks in the religious bookstores generally, not all of them certainly, but many of them would follow this position. The moral majority takes this position. And this is basically why I do not support the moral majority personally. I like all its positions, but it's theology. See, the ethics, the moral part of it, is good, but Mr. Falwell has to mix in with all this good emphasis on biblical morality his dispensational premillennialism. So you get that every now and then, if you listen to Falwell on TV any. In the restoration movement, this is also quite common. Not as common as it used to be, and perhaps not as common as the other views, but every now and then you see it. Some of our Bible colleges, not too many of them, however, but some of them would take a position similar to this. There is one of our Bible colleges, I will not mention its name, but it has a drama called The Everlasting Arms. You wouldn't know about this, would you, Arch? It has a drama called The Everlasting Arms. I think it's on film now. When I was a teenager, I saw this as a play. It was put on in our county down in Kentucky, Scott County, Kentucky. And people from our church went to it. Scared the daylights out of me. I tell you, I had nightmares after that because it was all about the tribulation time, you know, when everything was caving in and everybody was being persecuted. Man, I really had nightmares after that. But that was a popular position at this particular Bible college. If you've ever been to the Kiamichi Mountains, I'm sure you've heard this, because Brother Mac, bless his old gizzard, took this position and taught it and wrote a series of Bible lessons on the book of Revelation called God's Plan for the Ages, where he presented this Hal Lindsey type view, the Scofield view. There are a couple of fellows that circulate among us today who take this position, Raldo Cook for one, who is a singing evangelist. He's very vocal about this. And a brand new organization that has only begun the last couple of years called the Lion and the Lamb Ministry. I think from Texas. David Reagan, I believe, is the name of the man who started this. This is one of their main emphases. So you see, this is all around us. I'm sure you know that, or you wouldn't be here tonight if it weren't so prevalent. If it weren't something that people were so interested in and concerned about, you wouldn't even have asked me to come and talk about it, and you wouldn't be here to listen. But we'd ask the question, why do so many people see the Jews as having a key role in prophecy about the end of the world? The basic reason is because of certain preconceived ideas, I think, certain ideas about how one ought to interpret prophecy. It has to do with one's view of the very nature of prophecy and the way they look at prophecy. They have decided that all prophecy must be interpreted and fulfilled in one particular way. And that's really the key issue in this whole subject about the Jews and prophecy. Now, I've chosen this particular subject as the beginning point for the series that I'm giving this weekend for several reasons. For one thing, many Bible students do give the Jews a major, if not the principal role in Bible prophecy in the end times. So it is a subject that you have to talk about if you're going to talk about eschatology, if you're going to talk about the end times. Also, I think there's a natural curiosity about this. I mean, we read about it in the newspapers every day. And you say, well, is something over there in the Middle East going on that's talked about in the Bible? How do we handle that? Every time there's a new development, do we get out our Bible and see if we can find a reference to it in Daniel or Zechariah or Matthew or Revelation? This is just, I think, a kind of natural reaction on our parts. So that's one reason that I chose this for the beginning, sort of an attention getter. I wanted to lure you here, and maybe you'll come back. We're talking about Revelation tomorrow. But tonight it is the Jews in prophecy. But the main reason that we're talking about the Jews in prophecy tonight is because this is an ideal subject for investigating the very nature of Bible prophecy. It's an ideal subject for trying to understand what Bible prophecy is all about. Now, obviously, we're not going to be able to cover every prophecy in the Bible about the Jews, either tonight or this weekend as a whole. But what I would hope is that after even this one evening, you would be able to pick up your Bible and read some of the prophecy that's there. Take the Old Testament, take a book like Zechariah or Ezekiel, Isaiah, Daniel, and you wouldn't feel so lost about it, because you would have some idea of the kind of thing that God is intending to do through these prophets. Now, that doesn't mean that this one evening is going to give you a key to interpreting the Old Testament as a whole, but I hope that it will give you a starting point. I hope it'll give you a starting point for interpreting Bible prophecy in general. So this lesson tonight is not just about the Jews. It's about prophecy. For instance, is prophecy always literal? Or is it sometimes figurative? What does the Bible say? Or is prophecy always fulfilled in physical realities? Or is it possible that some prophecy might be fulfilled in spiritual realities? Well, these are some questions that we'll keep in mind as we begin this study here of Israel in prophecy. I have three main points. I believe you have an outline, the blue sheet. If anyone doesn't have that, I think there are some of the men who will be ready to give you a copy. Is there anyone who doesn't have an outline? Oh, the ushers did a great job. Give them an extra star on their chart, Art. Very good. So we will be looking at these three main points. And I doubt if we will be able to look up every Bible verse. We'll look up some of them, even if we can't look up all of them. Three main points about the nature of prophecy, the fulfillment of prophecy, especially as it relates to Israel. I'm going to put it this way. There are three things that you have to know in order to understand Bible prophecy. Three principles. And if you learn these three principles this evening, I think you will have gone a long way toward getting a grasp on the nature of Bible prophecy as you sit down to study it on your own. The first thing is, you must know what the Bible itself says about the nature of prophecy. See, one of the big questions is, must we take all Bible prophecy literally? Is all prophecy literal? This is a question because to many people, the only choice is between literal and liberal. And I hope that you will not look at it in that sense. It's not a question of whether you believe the Bible or not if you deny a literal interpretation. It's not a question of whether the Bible is true. It's a question of how shall we interpret the Bible. It's a matter of interpretation, not whether you're accepting its authority. Now, I don't find that clarified, though, in many places, because we have a big Baptist church in Cincinnati. By the way, not all Baptists are premillennialists. That's some kind of misunderstanding, and it doesn't do justice, I think, to many of our Baptist friends. It's mainly the independent Baptist churches that would be your strong premillennialists. The Southern Baptists would be probably a variety, but some of the best material on eschatology comes from the Southern Baptists. I saw a book in your church library. I couldn't believe it. Art says, now, just about everything here is restoration movement. Just about everything here is Church of Christ. And first thing I spotted was this Southern Baptist commentary. it was on the book of Revelation. Really? But it's a good one. I have it myself. It's a good one. But it really isn't true, you see, that when the Baptist preacher went to the doctor and the doctor says, open your mouth and say, ah, he said, never. You think about that one a while. Some Baptists, okay, like we have this big landmark Baptist, you know, remember that one? Now, they take the position that if you don't interpret prophecy literally, then you just don't believe the Bible. Well, that's not the issue. The issue is, assuming we believe the Bible is true, how must we interpret it? Must it always be interpreted literally? Now, our premillennial friends, such as Hal Lindsey, would say, yes, it must always be interpreted literally. On page 165 in his book, he says, one issue between the amillennial and the premillennial viewpoints is whether prophecy should be interpreted literally or allegorically. You could say figuratively. He says, this is an issue. Is it literal or is it figurative? Now, his position is that all prophecy is literal. All prophecy is literal. God has always, in the past, demonstrated that prophecy is fulfilled literally, and all prophecy about the future will be fulfilled literally. Well, what do we say about that? If you took that position, you see where that would lead you. It would lead you to say that every time the Bible talks about a temple, at least this is the way Lindsey would say it, if it says a temple, it means a building made of literal rock, literal wood, literal metals, and so on. If the prophecy says Jerusalem, then it has to refer to a piece of real estate over on the Mediterranean, in the Mediterranean area, in the state of Israel. It has to, because that's the nature of prophecy, according to Lindsey. But what do we say about it? One thing that I would say, this is in your outline. Now, I don't know if your outline has this typographical error or not. Look at it and see. Does it say language or speech in general is now or not? Not? Okay, that's correct. At an earlier time, when this was typed, had a typographical error, and it said, is now always literal? And that was just the opposite of what it wanted to say. It should say not. A language or speech in general is not always literal. See, we use figurative expressions all the time in our language. There are a whole number of figures of speech. I looked this up in the Encyclopedia Britannica a couple of years ago just to see what it said about language and figurative language, and there are just so many different kinds of figures of speech. You could write a whole book about it. We use them all the time. We talk about people having rocks in their heads, you know, and we don't really mean that. Or somebody pulled the wool over your eyes. Now, that didn't mean that somebody got Art's car seats and actually put them down over their heads. You ever see his wool car seats? You'll have to take a look. But, see, we use figurative expressions all the time. This is just the way language is. Language is not always literal. It would be unnatural to insist that all language should always be literal. It's contrary to the ordinary way we use language. So my question is, why should we insist on such an unnatural rule for Bible prophecy? It doesn't correspond with the way we use language ordinarily. It doesn't correspond with other biblical use of language. For instance, Jesus, in teaching, used figures of speech all the time. His parables were figurative, of course. And even as he spoke and taught, he used figures like speaking of people as foxes or snakes. Now, that's very figurative. So what we're being told is that in contrast to the way that we use language ordinarily, and in contrast to some of the clear, straightforward teachings of the Bible, which are figurative, that every time you come across a Bible prophecy, it's always literal. Well, I would say that's just totally unnatural. Not only is it unnatural, it goes against what the Bible itself says about the nature of prophecy. And that's what we're looking at right here under point B, that the Bible itself says that prophecy, as a rule, I don't think this is meant to be an absolute statement even here, because sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But what we will see in these passages is that it is not unusual for God to speak through his prophets in figurative language. The first of these passages is the 12th chapter of Numbers. This is an occasion where God is bawling somebody out. It happens to be Miriam and Aaron, Moses' brother and sister, not yours, this other Moses. This is the occasion where Miriam and Aaron were complaining about the woman that Moses married. And on this occasion, God spoke and said, "You had better think twice before you criticize my servant Moses, because he is special. Not only is he special in relation to the people in general, but as one of my prophets, as one of my spokesmen, he is special even in relation to other prophets." Now, I want you to notice the comparison that God gives here between Moses and other prophets. He says in verse 6, "Now hear my words. If there is a prophet among you," this would be in general, "I, the Lord, will make myself known to him in a vision. I will speak with him in a dream." That's the ordinary way of speaking to prophets, to ordinary prophets, visions and dreams. But with Moses, it's special. With my servant Moses, he is faithful in all my household. With him, I will speak mouth to mouth. What does that mean? Not in a vision or a dream, but I will just actually talk to him. And he will hear while he's wide awake. just like I'm talking to you right now, mouth to mouth. Not only that, but there's another contrast right after that. He says, I will speak with him openly and not in dark sayings. That's in contrast to ordinary prophecy, you see. With Moses, because he is special, I will just speak right out plain. Whereas ordinarily, I might speak in riddles. This is the word that means riddles, dark sayings, mysterious sayings. It's translated in the Greek Old Testament with the word that means enigma. It's enigma, in fact, in Greek. Enigma. Riddles. By the way, this is the verse I think Paul has in mind when he is writing 1 Corinthians 13 about the perfect. This is a good comparison to make. We were talking about that earlier. Different kinds of revelation. Some that is in riddles, some that is figurative, but some that isn't. Do you see? Ordinarily, he says, I speak in riddles when I speak through the prophets. Now, how can Hal Lindsey just make an arbitrary statement that all prophecy is literal when God says, not unusual at all to speak riddles, dark sayings? There's another Old Testament statement that gives some light on this from Hosea 12, verse 10. See, I've got to figure out where this is now. One of these days I'm going to learn the minor prophets. Okay, Hosea, not far after Daniel. Oh, yeah, okay, I got it. Hosea 12, verse 10. God is speaking, and he talks about speaking through the prophets. And he says, I have spoken to the prophets, and I gave numerous visions, just as he said in Numbers. And through the prophets I gave, what does your Bible say? Parables. King James, I think, says similitudes, which is figurative statements, figurative sayings, parables. Now, how in the world can someone then say all prophecy is literal when God says specifically that through the prophets he gives parables? There's one other passage we'll look at just briefly. I'll deal with it a little more tomorrow when we talk about the book of Revelation. But the very beginning of the book of Revelation suggests that this book of prophecy is symbolic or figurative, for the most part at least. In Revelation 1:1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his bondservants the things which must shortly take place. And he sent, and here's a place where I prefer something besides the New American Standard. We were talking about this today too, as to which translation actually is the best one to use. Well, I do use the New American Standard Bible because in most cases it captures the meaning of the original, I think, in an unambiguous way. Here, however, I would prefer, even King James, I think, over the New American Standard. You have a King James? I thought I saw you shake your head a while ago when I said similitudes. It says, and he sent and signified it by his angel to his bondservant John. Now, this is a word which in Greek is it's possible for it to have the very general meaning of communicated. It's possible. But it's also possible for it to have a more specific meaning that is suggested by the word signified. What are the first four letters of the word signified? S-I-G-N. Sign. And this is actually the specific meaning of the word. He sent and gave the message in signs or symbols. Figurative language. I think this is why the King James and some other translations use the word signified. Because the connotation, the more specific connotation, has to do with signs or symbols. Well, we won't press that point. We have the numbers in the Hosea passage for us for this evening, and we're dealing with the Jews in prophecy. But my conclusion is that it's much better to take the Bible's own statement about the nature of prophetic language than it is to make up your own rule. Now, I don't know about you, but I think you would probably agree with me that when one makes up his own rules about the nature of Bible prophecy and prophetic language and ignores specific statements in the Bible, no wonder he gets in trouble. No wonder he gets off base when it comes to interpreting Bible prophecy. Do you see what we're saying here? The very nature of the prophetic language, it's contrary to the Bible's own teaching to say that it must always be literal when the Bible says parables, riddles, dark sayings. Okay, any question about that point? To a large extent, yes. To a large extent, at least one of the problems, as they could not understand, for instance, when Jesus himself said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up." And they said, "How's he going to do that? It took us 46 years to build this temple." So they couldn't think beyond the literal. Yeah, right. And other things, too, from the Old Testament itself. Yeah, I think you're right. And it goes even beyond this point, that this was one of the problems that the Jews had in accepting the Messiah when he came the first time. They could not see beyond the literal meaning of prophecies. Yes, very true. And that will come out in my third point when we talk about the difference between physical realities and spiritual realities. Right. All right, here we've just been talking about the nature of the language and whether the language itself must always be literal. And we see that following biblical teaching, it cannot. Now, the second thing that you have to know to understand Bible prophecy. You have to know Bible history. Oh my, we're making it so hard. Can't you just go to the Bible and zero in on the prophecy without having to do all this preliminary work? Well, that's our nature too, isn't it? We like to avoid the preliminaries if possible and get right to the issues. Well, unfortunately, there are very few areas of life where that's possible. There are other things. There's background that has to be learned. And that is definitely true in this case, because we have to know something about Bible history. I'm thinking here especially of Old Testament history, the history of Old Testament Israel. Now, when we're talking about Old Testament Israel, we are talking about something that's very physical. We're talking about the national, physical Israel, the Jewish people who are physically descended from Abraham through Isaac and Jacob. Now, there are many prophecies. There are many prophecies about the Jewish people in the Bible. After all, this is the main subject of the Old Testament after Genesis 12, after the call of Abraham. The whole Old Testament after that point is what God was doing through the Hebrews, the Jewish nation. So the question is not whether there are prophecies about the Jews. Of course there are. The question is, when are these prophecies to be fulfilled? Is it possible that a large number Is it possible that most of the prophecies that have to do with Old Testament Israel, the physical national Jews, is it possible that most of the prophecies about these people have already been fulfilled? Or are we looking yet to the future for the prophecies concerning Old Testament Israel to be fulfilled? Now, if you looked at Mr. Lindsay or others of that kind, they would say that prophecies about Old Testament Israel have not yet been fulfilled. They're waiting. God has put those prophecies on hold. And he is going to start fulfilling them again at the time of the secret rapture. That's a fact. This is the view called dispensationalism. You are familiar with that term, dispensationalism, which says that God's main concern is for the Jewish nation. When Jesus came the first time, he came to set up the Jewish kingdom. Unfortunately, they would not cooperate, so God had to delay that plan, and he started the church instead to be a kind of time filler, a gap filler. Then at the end of time, when the time is right, he will come a second time and carry out all those plans for the Jewish kingdom. See, what it makes history like one big football game where the Old Testament's the first half, we're in the halftime activities, and then at the second coming, that'll be the second half. But we are in no continuity at all with what went before or what comes after. We're just the halftime filler. That is literally the case. I mean, that is exactly the way the dispensational premillennialist such as Hal Lindsey looks at the Bible. Well, I think a lot of the confusion here comes from not being familiar enough with Bible history. I've met some folks who read the prophecies about Israel's tribulation, for instance, or the rebuilding of the temple, who have no concept whatever of Old Testament history and how these are things that were fulfilled, let's say, in 536 B.C. or with the return down around 436. They have no concept that these things have already happened, that prophecies about these things have already been fulfilled, and therefore they keep looking to the future, not knowing Bible history and not knowing the fulfillment that's already taken place. The fact is that prophecies, and I believe most prophecies that refer to the Old Testament Israel, such things as Israel's return to their homeland, the rebuilding their temple, these things are already fulfilled. They were fulfilled in the Old Testament times themselves. So what we're doing here in this section is taking a brief look at some of the main events in the history of national Israel. We'll look at some of the prophecies that God gave for his people Israel, some of the events that were prophesied, and then we'll look at some Old Testament passages and some New Testament passages that show that these prophecies were already fulfilled. They have been fulfilled in the past. They're part of Bible history. That's this section of your outline here on the first side, the little chart that says event, prophesied, and fulfilled. You see that? Now, we're not going to look up every Bible reference. We'll look up some of them. I'll give you a couple of extra ones that aren't on the outline. But the first main event prophesied here, possession of Canaan, that the chosen people, Abraham's seed, would take possession of the promised land. This was prophesied in Genesis 12, verse 7. First, when the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." Remember where Abram was. He'd been called out of his homeland and brought over into what is now the land of Israel. And God says, "To your descendants I will give this land." We'll look up one other passage, and then I'll comment on it a little later. In Genesis 17, verse 8, this is repeated. This is also to Abraham. God says, "I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." We'll come back to that word there that struck you as we looked at it. There are other references. I've listed some of them here in the outline that you have. Other references to the fact that God would give the land to Israel. Now, did God fulfill those promises and those prophecies? Well, the answer to that is yes. God fulfilled His word. And you have a record of it. I've given you here two or three passages, and there are others that speak of God's faithfulness in giving the land to the descendants of Abraham. Deuteronomy 1:8 says, for instance, see, I have placed the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to them and to their descendants after them. Then you have the record in the book of Joshua, after Joshua took the people across the Jordan and was their leader while they took possession of the land. In the 21st chapter of Joshua, verse 43 says, so the Lord gave Israel all the land which He had sworn to give to their fathers, and they possessed it and lived in it. And verse 45, not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed. All came to pass. Yes, God kept His promise. He gave the land to the people. But now, I think probably I ought to go back and mention something about this word in Genesis 17, verse 8. Was there a word there that troubled you a little bit? What? Everlasting? For an everlasting possession? Did I read it right? Does it really say that? Well, you know, this is a verse that many people will look at today and say, well, you see, this shows that the Jews today have a rightful claim to that land of Israel. And that it's wrong for the Arabs or anybody else to try to take it away from them because God Himself has given it to them for an everlasting possession. Well, there are two things that I would say about that. What about this word everlasting? This is a Hebrew word pronounced olam. Olam. And if you looked at all the cases in the Old Testament where this word appears, you'll find that sometimes it means everlasting, sometimes it doesn't. For instance, the word olam is used to describe almost every aspect of the law of Moses. This will be an everlasting item for you. But if you look at some of the ways that it's used, here's what you will find. That it can mean everlasting, but it can also mean age-lasting, until the end of the age. And let me give you a couple of examples on that. I have a whole page of examples here where the word olam is used, where the meaning obviously does not mean forever. For instance, it is said that the Passover feast would last forever in Exodus 12:24. Well, we know, don't we, that when Christ came, He was the fulfillment of the figure that was represented in the Passover. It would be, I believe, a denial of the sacrifice of Jesus to try to start the Passover again. Christ is our Passover. He's the fulfillment of that. But it says it would be olam. Yes, it would last to the end of the age. A lot of the things that have to do with the temple worship last olam. The candlestick, the priest's clothing, the priest's washing ceremonies, all these things were described in the same way in the Old Testament. Or here's one, the Day of Atonement. In Leviticus 16, verse 29 and 31, the Day of Atonement is something that is described by this same word. Now, the Day of Atonement was also fulfilled when Jesus became the Lamb of God that took away the sins of the world. Not only that, but the priesthood. In Exodus 40, verse 15, The priesthood is described as being everlasting, the Aaronic priesthood. But what about the book of Hebrews? What does the book of Hebrews say? It says that priesthood is gone because Christ is now our high priest. Well, it's the same word. By the way, it also is used for the Sabbath day. So if you want to say that Israel is the possession of the Jews forever, we ought to be worshiping on Saturday, because that is also described as everlasting in Exodus 31, verse 16 and 17. The Levites as custodians of the ark, wherever it is. Well, the point I'm making here is that word everlasting there in Genesis 17, 8 is a word that has several meanings. And particularly when it's used with regard to the Old Testament dispensation of things, it came to an end with the first coming of Christ. You see, you look at all those things, such as I mentioned, that had to do with temple worship, Day of Atonement, the priesthood, the Ark of the Covenant, all those things found their fulfillment in Jesus of Nazareth when he came the first time. And I would say the exact same thing about the land of Canaan as a possession for the Jewish nation. Until God is finished with them, it's theirs. But not after that. To most of us it is, right. And it becomes very clear that this promise to Abraham had its limits. But now there's another thing that I would say about it also, and this takes us to the second event. All of God's promises, I believe, are conditional. They are conditional on our response. You know what I mean? God promises salvation to everyone. Now, does that mean everyone is going to be saved? No, it means those who respond. The condition is given. God promises to save, and he will keep his promise, but he expects us to keep our side of the covenant agreement also. And that also applied to every promise God gave to Israel. God gave them this land, but he gave it to them on the condition that they would remain faithful. The fact is, they did not remain faithful. The fact is that because of their unbelief, because of their apostasy, God actually took the land away from them in the Old Testament times itself. The fact that he brought some back was pure grace on his part, because they had forfeited the right to keep the land. Now, this is the second main event, the disobedience and captivity that's mentioned here. And there are a number of prophecies about it, but we'll look at only one. Deuteronomy 28. Deuteronomy 28. This is some prophecy, by the way. I wish you would read the whole thing. I'm sure many of you have. All of you have read it before. Read it sometimes in the context of trying to understand the end times. Here is a prophecy concerning the Jews and what God says is going to happen to them if they do not keep the covenant. We'll only read two or three verses right now. Verse 15. It shall come about, if you will not obey the Lord your God and observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I charge you today, that all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Now I challenge you to read what follows there and then read the book of Lamentations alongside it. And you will see that these very things that were prophesied here that would come upon the people because of their unfaithfulness did come upon them at the time of the captivity, the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, 586 B.C. Look specifically at verse 63. And it shall come about that just as the Lord delighted over you to prosper you and multiply you, So the Lord will delight over you to make you perish and destroy you. And you shall be torn from the land where you are entering to possess it. The Lord will scatter you among the peoples from one end of the earth to the other. Verse 65, among those nations you shall find no rest. There shall be no resting place for the sole of your foot, but there the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, and despair of soul. Well, did that take place? Well, it did. In two stages, you can read about them, different places. You can read about the final one here in 2 Kings, passage listed. You can read about the book of Lamentations. The book of Lamentations, as I said, parallels Deuteronomy 28. Because what's it talking about? It's talking about the days of the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonian armies. As the prophet Jeremiah looks out over this great city of Jerusalem after it had been practically leveled by the armies, and he wept and lamented at what had gone on in the months preceding the actual destruction. And he wept to see the condition it was in. I talked to a young man, I guess he was about 75 at the time. His name was Ben Leedy, member of a church out in the Philadelphia area. I was preaching part-time for that church when I was going to school out there. Brother Leedy was commenting one day about the book of Lamentations. He just was kind of making an offhand remark about it, and he said, "Have you seen there in the book of Lamentations what it's going to be like in the end times? What it's going to be like during the tribulation?" I said, "Brother Leedy, you got a big surprise coming." That happened almost 600 years before Christ. He said, "It did?" Now here was a man that had grown up in the church. He was a faithful servant, good Bible student, at least I'm sure he thought. And here he was reading the book of Lamentations as if it had nothing to do with Bible history, as if it were some kind of prophecy of the end times. And it really came as a surprise to him to learn that this referred to an event that had already happened in Old Testament history.
The same thing happened again about 40 years after Christ. Just starting in Jerusalem, and then you'll see
exactly, and you see the same kind of misunderstanding today too, as people take Jesus' statements in Matthew 24 that deal with that destruction of Jerusalem and try to make it refer to something yet in the future. Exactly the same parallel. Well, we must press on here. I told you I wouldn't take 12 hours, but Art said I could have till 9 o'clock. And he also told me that the people who got up to leave had to go to work or something, that they weren't just mad. And I hope he's right. The next event in the history of Old Testament Israel is their return to their homeland and the rebuilding of the temple. Now, this is the biggie today. See, this is the biggie. Because, as Lindsay says, here's what's got to happen before Jesus comes again. You've got to have Israel going back. You've got to have them retaking their possession of the sacred sites. And you've got to have them rebuilding the temple. Because there are prophecies about these things. And you do have the prophecies. There are prophecies as listed here. Deuteronomy 30, following up on the Deuteronomy 28 passage. For instance, where God says, "So it shall become when all of these things have come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind in all the nations where the Lord your God has banished you, and you return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart and soul according to all that I command you today, then the Lord your God will restore you from captivity and have compassion on you and will gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. If your outcasts are at the ends of the earth, from there the Lord your God will gather you, and from there he'll bring you back. And the Lord your God will bring you into the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it, and he will prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers." To the passages on your list, you might want to add a couple of verses. You might add Jeremiah 29, verse 14. Jeremiah 29, verse 14, where God says, I will be found by you, and I will restore your fortunes, and gather you from all the nations and from all the places where I have driven you, and I will bring you back to the place from where I sent you into exile. See also Jeremiah 30, verse 18, which is similar. Behold, I will restore the fortunes of the tents of Jacob, and the city shall be rebuilt on its ruin, and so on. Also add Ezekiel 34, verse 11 to 14. We won't take time to read those. Now, question? Yes. One that I didn't include here that could be included would be Zechariah. Let me see. Let me find that one for you. This is a big one. I was going to refer to it later, but since you mentioned that, that triggered in my mind. Zechariah, I believe it's chapter 6, verses 12 to 15, which talks about the rebuilding of the temple. He will build the temple of the Lord. He will build the temple of the Lord. And those who are far off will come and build the temple of the Lord. Now, one reason I didn't include that one is because I think that does not refer to Old Testament history, but to the spiritual Israel that will come about later. I guess that's why I left it out here, come to think of it. But the prophecies that I've just mentioned, along with some other prophecies that have to do with the building of the church, putting them together, are referred to the time of the second coming. Well, what I'm saying here is that according to Old Testament history, these prophecies, the ones that are listed here and the ones I gave you from Jeremiah and Ezekiel, were fulfilled in 536 B.C. And you read about it in the book of Ezra. We won't take time to look at it, but in the book of Ezra, also the book of Haggai, you can read how Israel was brought back to their homeland, and how they rebuilt the city, and with a little prodding from Haggai, the temple. These are things that already took place. I heard a Bible college teacher once, who was a Hal Lindsey type. I heard him talking about the nation of Israel and how God had dealt with them. And he talked about the great events of Old Testament history, or the great events in Israel's history. He was reciting them all the way from Abraham through Moses and David and Christ. And I was just shocked when, in pointing out the highlights of Israel, he completely omitted this restoration from Babylon, the restoration from captivity. When to the mind of any Jew, that would rank second only to the Exodus from Egypt. The restoration to their homeland. But I know why it wasn't real sharp in his mind, because all these prophecies that pointed ahead to this great event in 536 B.C., in his mind, were rolled ahead to the time of the second coming. So, but I would insist here that when we read these prophecies, many of them were fulfilled in 536, down through about 516, when the temple finally got built. One last event in Israel's history, and this is one of the main ones. Now, I could have added another one that happened after this, and somebody pointed it out a while ago, namely the final destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. But I chose here to conclude the events in Israel's history with the first coming of Christ. And I don't think we need to take time to read the prophecies that have to do with the first coming of Christ, because there are so many of them. But my point here is that all the prophecies and promises that had to do with Old Testament Israel were fulfilled in the great event of the first coming of Christ. It is my firm conviction that once Jesus came, the first time, God was finished with national, physical Israel as a separate, special people. Now, that takes no honor at all away from their role as the nation that God chose to be the seedbed for the sending of the seed of Abraham. No honor is taken away at all. But it does an injustice, I believe, not only to the Jewish nation of the Old Testament, but to the Church of Jesus Christ today, to say that God still has some special purpose designed for Israel, when that wasn't the idea at all. The idea for choosing a special nation, the Israelites, was to prepare for the first coming of Jesus. Preparation is the key word. And when Christ came the first time, all the promises, all the prophecies concerning Israel's role in God's plan came to a climax. Now, one passage we can read on that, I've given you several here, but in the 13th chapter of the book of Acts, the Apostle Paul is preaching about the promises that God made to the fathers, about verse 30 and following. He's talking about the death and resurrection of Jesus. And he says in verse 30 that God raised him from the dead. For many days he appeared to those who came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, the very ones who are now his witnesses to the people. And we preach to you the good news of the promise made to the fathers, that God has fulfilled this promise to our children, in that he raised up Jesus. As it is written, Thou art my Son, today have I begotten thee. In the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, the promises made to the fathers came to a climactic crescendo, and now we're on a different level altogether. In Acts 28:20, Jesus is called the hope of Israel. See, everything Israel stood for came to a point in this first coming of Jesus. Now there is no longer a reason for the separate, special existence of Israel as a nation. See, Israel was the object of many prophecies. Israel is the deserving recipient of many honors. But what God had to say about Israel and what God did with Israel came to this climactic end when Jesus came the first time, not the second time. That, I believe, is the point of serious confusion. It takes away all the honor that Israel deserves for the first coming of Jesus. And if you look at what Paul said in the book of Romans about the blessings that Israel received for being the nation that God chose, you could read chapter 3, what advantage has the Jew? Great in every respect. First of all, they were entrusted with the oracles of God. They were the ones that God gave his revelation to. They're the ones that prepared and kept the Old Testament. In chapter 9, he says, concerning the Israelites, concerning his brethren, his kinsmen according to the flesh, verse 3. Verse 4, the Israelites, to whom belongs the adoption as sons and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the temple service and the promises, whose are the fathers and from whom is the Christ according to the flesh, who is over all, God blessed forever. You can't go any further than that, folks. That's the greatest honor that God could bestow on any nation, to choose them as the one from whom would come the Christ according to the flesh. If I were a member of the Jewish race, physical Jewish race, I wouldn't want anybody to take that honor away from me by saying, oh, that was not really intentional. See, to somebody like Hal Lindsey, it's an accident, more or less, that Christ has to come the second time. It's almost like saying his first coming failed, because he has to turn around now and come again to do what he intended to do the first time, namely set up a Jewish kingdom. No, God knew what he was doing all along. And God knew that this nation of Israel was going to serve his purpose, and it's a great honor that from them would come the Christ according to the flesh, the first coming of Jesus.
But he answered and said, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.
Well, he's talking about the scope of his ministry. See, his ministry, this is why God had prepared a single nation, so that when Jesus came, there would be someone who should have known what he was all about. And it was to that nation that he came and established himself. It was to them that he preached. It was in their midst that he was crucified. It was in their midst that he rose again. It was from their ranks that he then were to go out into all the world. See, this is part of the plan. This is the launching pad, so to speak, to use a contemporary example. Israel's the launching pad. But then the next generation, you see, the apostles and the church after, go into all the world now. But his own mission, the scope of it, basically was here in this one nation, because that was what God was doing all along, is preparing this people to receive Christ so that they then, at least the remnant who were faithful, that they would receive him and be the missionaries to all the world. It wasn't Jesus' purpose to come and himself go into all the world. That's what he's entrusted to us. I have to push on here. Art's going to turn out the lights and take away my cough drops at 9 o'clock. Third thing, second side. The third thing you have to understand, to understand Bible prophecy, you must understand that all reality is not physical. All reality is not physical. See, there are at least two kinds of reality. There's the physical and the spiritual. It's a mistake to think that all prophecy has to be fulfilled in physical realities, such as national Israel, because there are many prophecies about Israel, about Jerusalem, and about the temple, which don't have anything to do with the physical reality of the Jewish nation, the physical temple, or physical Jerusalem. It's a mistake to think that these always refer to the physical nation, the physical Jerusalem, a physical building. Because the Bible is very clear that there are two levels that we're talking about here. There are two levels. There's a physical temple, there's a spiritual temple. There's a physical Israel, there's a spiritual Israel. There's a physical Jerusalem, there is a spiritual Jerusalem. And they're both real. See, there are some who would say, yeah, but it's the physical that's the real. Well, all right, it's real, but isn't the spiritual real too? What does Peter say about the church? You are built up as living stones into a spiritual house. I'm real. But being a temple, you see, this is like a spiritual house, he says. Not physical, like this building, but spiritual. Yes. Yeah, I think that's true, especially when you're thinking of the progression of the interpretation of prophecy, because often you will hear it said, well, couldn't you have a double fulfillment? Couldn't you have a fulfillment, say, in the church, and then later on, a fulfillment in the millennium? I would say that's going the wrong direction. See, the progression is from the physical to the spiritual. Isn't that the main message of the book of Hebrews? You've got all those physical types in the Old Testament times. They were preparation. They were pointers to the real. And now we're in the age of the real. The real temple, let me not say the real, but if you want to put it that way, the more real, or the higher reality. We're in the age of the higher reality when we're in the age of the church, the spiritual temple. And I just resist the idea that we're going to go back down, which is what would happen if these prophecies had still another fulfillment back on the physical level. We've been lifted up once. I think God wants us, if anything, to go further, and that is to the new heavens and the new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness, the final stage. Let me come back here and give you just a couple passages on this. Look at Galatians 4. Galatians 4 makes it clear that we're talking about two levels or two kinds of reality. Starting at verse 21, you see a contrast between... Well, actually, between the Jewish nation, the old Israel, and the church, which is the new Jerusalem or the new Israel. And he uses here the analogy of Abraham's two women, the bondwoman Hagar and his wife Sarah. And he says, let me tell you, it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the bondwoman, one by the free. The son by the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, the son by the free woman through the promise. Now this contains an allegory. For these women are two covenants, the old and the new. One proceeding from Mount Sinai, bearing children who are to be slaves, that's Hagar. Now this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and she corresponds to this present Jerusalem, that is the one you see here before your eyes, the physical Jerusalem, that's Mount Sinai. She is in slavery with her children. That's the old Israel. But now notice in verse 26, but the Jerusalem above. You see the contrast? The Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother. That's remarkable that the Apostle Paul would say that, because he was the Hebrew of the Hebrews. But he no longer claims his basic identity with the physical, with the old Jerusalem, but he says, our mother is the Jerusalem which is above. And he quotes some Old Testament passages and says, and you, brethren, like Isaac, are children of promise. But just as at that time he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him born according to the Spirit, so it is now also. You see those two expressions in verse 29? Born according to the flesh, born according to the Spirit. Those are the two levels. Those are the two realities. The one born according to the flesh, physical Jews. The ones born according to the Spirit, spiritual Jews. The Jerusalem that is above. It's real. It's just as real. Now what I'm saying here is that prophecies, Old Testament prophecies concerning Israel, the temple, Jerusalem, who says they have to be fulfilled in the physical reality? There is another reality. And that's what most of us are saying, you see. Let's pay attention to this, to what the New Testament teaches about this other reality. I don't have time to go into all this point A. Let's just take notice here. When you read through the New Testament, points 1, 2, and 3, the New Testament identifies the church as God's temple. We are the temple of God. And here are some passages. You can look them up. It identifies the church as God's Jerusalem. We just looked at Galatians 4. You could also look at Hebrews 12:22, which talks about Zion, the heavenly Zion. That's us. It also identifies the church as God's Israel. Israel, according to the, not according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. Galatians 3, all those who are believers in Jesus are the sons of Abraham. I wish we had more time, but we'll have to skip on down here. Point B, the church as the new Israel is composed of believing Jews and believing Gentiles. See, we're in the new Israel today. You and I are Israelites. So is every Jew who is part of the church. There is no longer a distinction between physical Jews and physical Gentiles. That's not the way God distinguishes people today. There is neither Jew nor Greek, says Galatians 3:28, and many other passages along the same line. Because we're all children of God by faith in Jesus Christ. That's what makes the people of God today. The church is the new Israel, the true Israel in the world today. And this is the way you interpret Old Testament prophecy. Let me give you a few examples from point C then, and we'll have to come to some kind of a screeching halt here. Let me give you a few examples. What we're looking at in this section is some Old Testament prophecies about Israel, which the New Testament specifically says are fulfilled in the spiritual Israel, the church. Jeremiah 31, Art has already referred to this. This is the passage about the new covenant. Jeremiah 31, verse 31 and following, "Behold, the days are coming when I'll make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant I made with their fathers in the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt." It goes on down through verse 34. Now, if I were to ask you, how many here tonight believe that we are living under this covenant right now? Let me see. How many would say, yes, we are living under this covenant? Oh, the new covenant. I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel. How many believe we're under this new covenant? That's most of you. Maybe there's some who would say no. Well, who could say no? I mean, after all, isn't this what Jesus refers to in Luke 22:20 when he says, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood"? And doesn't the book of Hebrews twice quote these four verses from Jeremiah? Twice, Hebrews 8 and Hebrews 10, and point out, we are no longer under the old covenant. We are under this new covenant, the one sealed by the blood of Christ. That's the one we're under, the new covenant. But there are many people today who would say, if asked, "Do you believe we're under this new covenant?" They say no. You know why? Well, if you look back, it says, "I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah." And that has to mean only one thing, the physical Israel, the physical Judah. I mentioned the Bible college professor that I heard talking about the Old Testament or the Jews earlier. He was asked this question in the presentation that he gave. "Do you believe we're under the new covenant?" "No." And you read the dispensational. He's no longer teaching at a Bible college, by the way. I don't think it's related, but ask the dispensationalists like Lindsay. You see, they can't really take it to refer to today because it's Judah and Israel. And they cannot see beyond the physical reality. When it's very obvious from the New Testament teaching that you and I are under this new covenant. We are the Israel with which the new covenant is made, the spiritual Israel. The Amos passage is a good one. This is a good one because it's specifically quoted in the 15th chapter of Acts as being fulfilled in the church. What does the Amos passage say? Wait till I find it here. This is in the Minor Prophets. Let me see. Hosea, Joel, Amos. All right. Amos 9, verse 11 following. "In that day I will raise up the fallen tabernacle of David." Talking about the temple. "I'll raise up the fallen tabernacle of David." And it goes on to talk about some other things. The nations coming in and helping to rebuild it. Fallen tabernacle of David. Oh, I know, that refers to that temple that's going to be built out of Indiana Bedford stone. No, sir, if you read the 15th chapter of Acts, you will see it quoted specifically as referring to the fact that God is building the church and using the Gentiles to do it. There is a prophecy about the temple, the tabernacle of David, and the New Testament specifically says it refers to the church. Well, I heard a beeper, so I've got to go to my conclusion here. Does God still have the plan for Israel as a nation? Does God have a separate plan for Israel? Lindsay would say so. Lindsay says, "For us as believers, our hope is different from Israel's." Page 128 in the edition I have. Our hope is different from Israel's. I recall reading somewhere once that there's only one hope. You remember reading that somewhere? I think that was in the Bible, as a matter of fact. Ephesians 4:4, there's only one hope. Whether you're a physical Jew or a physical Gentile, there's only one hope. And that hope is in Christ. And that hope is in Christ today. There is no special place for physical Jews today. But there is a place. Where is that place? In the church. That's exactly right. It is in the church. If you read the 11th chapter of Romans, the parable of the olive tree, remember that? It's so clear. People make so much out of this and refer it to the end times and say it shows that God's going to bring Israel back. But what it's saying is just the opposite. It's saying that any Jew who wants to be saved has to join the church. There's the salvation. There's the place. If you read it, he says concerning the olive tree. What is the olive tree? Well, the olive tree is the people of God from the Old Testament. That's where it starts. The Jews. But what happens when Jesus came the first time? What happens to the Jews who didn't believe in Jesus? They were broken off because of unbelief. If they didn't believe in Jesus, they were broken off from their own olive tree. What happened to Gentiles who did believe in Jesus? They are grafted in. And what did God say concerning those that he broke off? Well, that he said something like that in John 15. Here he says something else. He says in verse 23, if they do not continue in their unbelief, they can be grafted in again. Any branch broken off can be grafted in again, for God is able to graft it in again. There's the place for any Jew that wants to be saved. And I think there's some here who can praise the Lord for that, that God has a place. For Gentiles and Jews, it's all one place. It's in the church. God's temple. God's Jerusalem. God's Zion. God's Israel. That's who we are. We're going to bring the service to a close since it is 9. And I don't know if you want to do this, Art. Do you want to sing the song now and let me stay afterwards for those who want to stay for a question and answer period? Do you want to have the song and prayer first, or how do you want to do it? Okay, we will close the service, but then I will stay here. If any of you has some questions and want to gather up around, we can discuss it for a while anyway.